morning. Professor Russ Hurwig is a research associate professor right here in the School of Aquatic and Fisheries Sciences at UW, and he does fascinating work on the spread of invasive aquatic organisms by ships, and that's what we're talking about today. Got a great background. He received his bachelor's degree in biology from Muhlenberg College. Now, here's your question. Does anyone know where Muhlenberg College is?
Wow.
Bill Clinton was there 2 weeks ago, right?
It's in Allentown, Pennsylvania. Does anybody know where Allentown is?
No.
Okay. He received his master's degree in marine science from William & Mary. He received his PhD right here at the University of Washington in fisheries with a concentration in marine microbiology. And he's a self-professed advocate for the microbial world. He says, being an advocate for the unseen biological world is an awesome responsibility, but most microbes are not even doers, as many people think. I'd like to set the record straight. That was a great quote. And this is third time he likes doing home repair, running, bicycling, and doing triathlon. Well, let's offer a warm, enthusiastic welcome to Professor Russ Hurwig.
Are you on there?
I think so.
Okay.
I'm gonna turn it off. That should be it.
All right.
Good morning, everyone. Did you all get your taxes filed in time?
I have a 6 month postponement. I couldn't figure it out last night, so too busy figuring this out here today. Well, this is my title. We'll see how far I get. I have a propensity of having too many slides oftentimes, and I've been trying to cut this down. So hard to figure out what slide to leave out. So first but not least, I want to just briefly introduce the little team we have in the School of Aquatic and Fishery Sciences, and a lot of the work that I'll be describing today is a tribute to these individuals. Jeff Cordell has been actually working at the University of Washington coming up to 30 years now, and his expertise is in zooplankton and invasion biology. And he's a scientist with our group. And Dave Lawrence has only been with us for 3 years. He comes from the East Coast. His expertise in phytoplankton and also database management. And then we have a woman that used to work. In fact, she was actually trained in the former Soviet Union, which is actually kind of a nice background to have if you're looking at invasive species that are coming from Asia and from the Eastern Pacific Ocean. Her name is Olga Collada. She works with zooplankton, and now I have a graduate student in the School of Marine Affairs, Nisa Furman, who's also another zooplankton expert with our group. There's a whole variety of projects. I'm not going to belabor this slide. It's one of these slides, too many things to read at one time. But just to let you know, we're involved with a wide variety of projects related to the transfer of non-indigenous species by ships, and primarily the introductions that are occurring through ballast water. Now, in more recent years, it's also become an interest in what's on the outside of ships, and I won't talk about that too much today, but maybe invite me back in a couple of years and I can tell you a little more about that. But we're looking mostly with the water that's being carried on ships in the form of ballast, and we've been involved with various agencies, such as the Washington Department of Fish and Wildlife, who is the Washington agency that regulates ballast water discharge in the state of Washington. It's not the Department of Ecology, it's Fish and Wildlife. Then involved with various sorts of treatments, such as ultraviolet light, and we involved with ozone and sodium hypochlorite, which is just a fancy word for bleach. Okay. And then we're also involved with some other projects, and more recently we just became involved with a whole fouling project here on end. So I can, if there's any time at the end, I could talk about that. And also we have to acknowledge that research costs money, and so rather than showing this slide at the end, I'll show it in the beginning. And just some of the agencies, mostly federal agencies, have been supporting the research that we've been doing in our laboratory. Quite a bit of our funding comes from National Sea Grant Program, U.S. Fish and Wildlife, Washington Sea Grant, which is a federally funded agency that's operated out of the state of Washington. And then actually we've been getting some money from various industries who are interested in trying to capitalize on this problem of non-indigenous species that are carried in ballast water. Okay. This is what I'm going to try to get through today. First, I'm going to provide a fairly substantial background to you about ballast. And the first thing I need to let you know that ballast is not bilge water. Okay, quite often I start cringing when people start introducing me and say, oh, he does research on bilge water. Okay, no, we don't do research on bilge water. It's in ballast water. This is the water that ships intentionally carry around with them. Bilge is the water that
or other liquids that accumulate at the bottom of the ship in the engine room, and so it includes oils and that sort of thing. So they don't want to accumulate that. They do have to carry ballast water. A wide variety of different kinds of ships are going around the world. We live in a major port area, Port of Seattle, Port of Tacoma, are some of the largest ports on the West Coast. I'll talk about some of what I call the famous and not-so-famous introductions. I think some of you have probably heard some of this, and I'll throw out some questions about that. We've spent a fair amount of our time just trying to figure out what non-indigenous organisms are coming into the state of Washington in the form of ballast, and I'll talk about that sampling that we've been working with for almost 7 years now, about who's coming into the state of Washington. And then once we realize there's a problem, what can we do about it? And so we were looking at ballast water treatment, and I'll talk a little bit about this and give you some examples how we do some of those experiments about treating ballast water to eliminate organisms that are in ballast water. Then finally, some concluding remarks at the end, piece of philosophy. First of all, why do ships have ballast water? And so there's some wonderful photographs to show you sort of ballast water gone wild on some of these ships. And so this is actually a photograph that was in the Seattle Times a few years ago. Brand new ship. Brand new ships on very nice calm water. Shouldn't be tilting it to this degree. Okay, so this is sort of ballast water going wild. Okay, and so the water is supposed to be in the ballast tanks on this side of the ship where it wasn't present. It was all on this side, so the ship tipped over. So this basically shows you why ships have ballast, is to maintain stability and trim, if you want to use nautical terms. And then even more recently, maybe some of you caught the news about the Cougar Ace. This is a ship that was carrying cars from Asia to North America and off the Gulf of Alaska. They had problems transferring some of the ballast water from one tank to the other. Once again, ballast water going wild. Okay, brand new cars inside of this ship sort of did a lot of damage to those cars when they presented this angle. Okay. This is referred to as a roll-on, roll-off vessel. Okay, so basically you drive your cars onto it, fill it up, and then roll them off. Okay, so it looks kind of like a big box. But the ballast tanks on this side of the ship were obviously not filled with the appropriate amount of water to contribute to the stability of that vessel. Okay. Now, as I said earlier, Port of Seattle, Port of Tacoma are very major ports on the West Coast. And one of the major commodities that the Port of Tacoma and Port of Seattle are involved with is international trade with agricultural products, grains, and that sort of thing. So this is downtown Seattle, looking downtown to the north here. And if you look to the north, you'll see these silos that are near the waterfront. And those silos are filled with grain, okay, and that grain goes onto ships. And when these ships arrive at the Port of Seattle, there's no cargo. They're not bringing cargo into the States. The cargo they bring is actually ballast water that's in their cargo holds or the center of this vessel where all this grain is going into in order to maintain stability and the transit from Asia or other countries into the United States. They have to fill those cargo holds actually with seawater or other sorts of water, fresh water. And so all the water we used to be in here has to be pumped out, and then they're filled with this grain that's being poured into this ship on a sunny day like today. You know, so this is sort of a little bit of a comedy act here goes on, because they can only put the grain in the ships when it's sort of sunny and not raining outside. Of course, most of the grain's harvested late fall, so it goes into the fall and winter when things start getting more rainy here, and so they have to close these doors when it starts raining, open the doors when it's not, when it's not raining, fill it up. And the reason for that, they don't want this to get a lot of high moisture content, because that could lead to the formation of mold, and it's very undesirable if you're trying to sell this grain to other countries if it's all moldy. Okay. So how many railroad cars do you think it takes to fill up a ship with grain? And you'll see this right along the railroad tracks there. All these cars are lined up, upgrade inside, and they'll dump them out, and it goes onto the ship. And so we have, take a guess, what do you think?
104.
What was that?
104.
Oh, you're way off. But you didn't say 3 or 4, so it wasn't too bad. It's 700 railroad cars of grain to go into one vessel. So as I said earlier, that cargo hold that takes the grain when it comes to Seattle, it's coming in with seawater. So it's basically 700 railroad cars of ballast water that's contained in the cargo hold that's being discharged before they can put that grain onto that ship. So that's a large volume. Okay, everyone's looking for equivalents, because we deal with terms and metrics that I can talk about metric tons of seawater and what's that? Metric tons of 1,000 liters and how many swimming pools is that, that sort of thing. If you do a cross section on one of those ships that's carrying ballast, whatever, or cargo, it looks somewhat like this. And there's all variations. There's dozens of different kinds of ship vessel types. And so you put the cargo in the center, okay, after the cargo hold. Then along the outside, the perimeter of this cross section of the ship is where the ballast tanks are located. And ships usually have ballast tanks in pairs, obviously. There's like port side and starboard side of the ship. And so they'll have, you know, the same location on the ship, port side, starboard side. And so the ship has to maintain a balance between right and left, the port and starboard side, in order to maintain a proper trim. And so oftentimes ballast tank that's on the top of the vessel is actually connected to the ones on the bottom. So there's some variations where this wall may be going down sort of the side here. So it's a cubic water going down the side here. So they're adjusting this in order to maintain their proper trim in the water and balance on the vessel. Okay. And you look inside, and we call it a ballast tank. And actually you can think of each tank as actually just a series of tanks that are sort of plastered together, with these openings in between these series of tanks that create this one tank. But the reason I show you this illustration is just to indicate there's a lot of internal structure that provides the strength for that vessel. You're thinking of organisms, whether those zooplankton, phytoplankton, microorganisms. There's a lot of places in niches and crannies where ballast water, it has sediments, can sort of hang up there. So it's not a really perfectly, never achieve perfectly good mixtures within these tanks because of all the internal structure that's there to provide strength for that vessel. Okay. So why do we care about it? Okay. And I'll go through some categories here. First of all, we care about if you're interested in the ecology or conservation of biology on the planet Earth. Environmental impact and ecological disruption. Okay. And there's different terms that are used and they mean slightly different things, but oftentimes they're used interchangeably. And we have non-indigenous species. Okay. Transferring one species from one part of the world to another, it's not down there. Okay, it's non-indigenous. Aquatic nuisance species, so maybe non-indigenous, and it becomes a sort of a judgment you're made to get whether it's a nuisance or not. Well, the clog a waterway up, cause some kind of environmental perturbation where it becomes a nuisance. Okay, non-aligned introductions may be considered nuisances. Okay. Aquatic invasive species, not all introductions are successful. Okay, a lot of non-indigenous species introduced, but few become established. The ones that become established are described as invasive species. Okay. We have to talk about public health and animal health impacts. Okay, there's some indications that perhaps some human pathogens may have been transferred from one part of the world to another in the form of in ballast water. And the example that's often given is Ribeye cholera. Okay, I'll talk about that in a second. There's some evidence of some harmful algal bloom species, okay, may have been transferred in ballast water. And lastly, something that's received quite a bit of attention actually in the last several months in the Midwest is something called VHS, viral hemorrhagic septicemia. It's a fish pathogen. And the suggestion is that that may be transferred around in the Midwest, various waterways, in the form of ballast. Okay. So those are pathogenic organisms, not for humans, but for wildlife or aquacultured animals. And then lastly, probably why people are most concerned about the transfer of non-indigenous species, economic impact. When you start talking money, you start talking about cost, okay, people begin to pay attention. Okay. So, who is the poster for ballast water invasions in North America? Who wants to take a guess at that one?
I guess in the state or a person?
Species. Zebra mussels. Okay. Everybody heard of zebra mussels?
Yeah.
Anybody from the Midwest?
Midwest.
If you grew up in the Midwest, you know zebra mussels very well. And they have actually a campaign, Zap the Zebras.
Okay.
And this is a pamphlet that was produced several years ago with the goal of preventing its introductions into the West Coast here, or preventing it getting over the Rocky Mountains. Does anybody know if that's been successful or not? I'll tell you if you don't know.
Okay. Anyway, if you want to know what a zebra mussel looks like, probably the most widely used photograph for a zebra mussel is next to this person's nice fingernail.
It's like everywhere. Then these are not huge mussels. Okay. They may not be huge, but they're very prolific. Okay.
And they tend to
reproduce in areas where there's flowing water, such as pipes. Okay, this is where the problem is in the Midwest. You have a pipe in the water, it's flowing water, fresh water in through that pipe. These are fresh water, by the way, you know, organisms. Oftentimes, the zebras like to colonize that and begin to proliferate, and it causes problems if you're trying to pump water through that. So we'll show the obligatory spread of the zebra mussels. You go to a website and get the photo or the image from 1988. It was joining in Canada, but just over the United States. It was produced by the United States Geological Survey. And you begin to see some red dots here around some of the Great Lakes. And so they have a series of photographs or maps of the spread of zebra mussels, and I'll just go to the most current one that I found, actually produced just a month ago. In March 2008, begin to notice some of the dots kind of follow where the water was, where the rivers are and streams and that sort of thing. So there was a massive campaign, or at least some thought, maybe thought it was massive, but probably not massive enough to prevent the zebra mussels from migrating west of the 100th meridian. Okay, well, you notice there's a red dot here, and that's way past the Rocky Mountains. That's in California, actually in Northern California. And you also notice there's some green dots here, and this is actually a relative of the zebra mussel, we'll now refer to as the quagga mussel. Same genus, different species. And just last year, they found these in some reservoirs in Southern California. Okay, so those also were introduced. All these originated from Eastern York, introduced through ballast water in late 1980s. Done very well, spreading all around, costing a lot of money for the mitigation. So in January, this was actually an article out of the Los Angeles Times. It was first discovered in a reservoir near San Francisco. And so if you look at a map of California in a little more detail, the green dot here refers to the presence of the zebra mussels, and its close relative, which is also a non-indigenous species, okay, in North America, down here in Southern California, being spread. So we're going to get a little bit nervous in the Pacific Northwest whether or not these non-indigenous species will be introduced into the Northwest. Once again, these are freshwater organisms, okay, introduced via ballast water into North America. Zebra mussel on the left, quagga mussel on the right. And just to let you know, it's not just not zebra mussels. So we have a little mantra here. You can repeat after me. It's not just zebra mussels. It's not just zebra mussels. Okay. I sped that up this morning. It used to be a lot slower. In the interest of waking you up at 8:30 in the morning, I sped it up. Okay. We have other organisms that are non-indigenous that haven't been documented being present in the Pacific Northwest. Anybody know what a copepod is? Okay. Some people refer to the copepods as the insects of the oceans or marine environments. They're not this large. They're actually about millimeters in size. Okay. And so my colleague, Jeff Cordell, who I showed you a photograph in one of the first few slides, he's a copepodologist. Okay, it's like, whoa, somebody never saw anybody get so excited about copepods when they talk to another person who likes copepods. And so you stand back and wow. People get off on that. It's kind of cool, I guess. Anyway, they're really fascinating organisms. I'm really envious. My background is in microbiology, and so the things that these guys can do, they can take a sample, you know, preserve it from aldehyde, take it back, look at it, next week, the week after, whatever, and tell you what species it is, particularly if it's the adult forms. Lots of some difficulties if it's a nauplii or smaller forms of the organism. But they can identify the species, and it's very hard to do that with microorganisms. Anyway, this one particular species, the Pseudodiaphanus, first appeared in 1990 in the Columbia River. And Jeff, when he was out doing his survey, he was just astonished. Wow, this non-indigenous species, which originated from Asia, Japan, China, Korea, just totally dominated all the copepods that were there. So the natural indigenous copepod was replaced by this non-indigenous copepod. And he said it's almost like a monoculture of copepods, this one species that was present in the Columbia River. And so it displaced native copepods. It's important in the diet of crabs and mice and shrimp. Okay, so obviously plays a very important role in the food webs there. Then he went back later and he said, wow, I can't find this Pseudodiaphanus anymore. I found another species of copepod that was introduced. So you can actually have successions of non-indigenous organisms being introduced into an environment. And these successions may occur rapid or very slow. And it was just very startling to him that this one species of Pseudodiaphanus was replaced by another Pseudodiaphanus, and when he went down there in 2002, he couldn't find this first one anymore.
Then he found another genus, Oikona, Davisi. Okay, and these are planktonic organisms that live in a water column. And they did some sediment sampling, and they actually found there was an invasive species in the sediments that was introduced. So we can document these introductions of non-indigenous organisms, such as copepods. But quite honestly, a lot of people don't get too excited about it. And it's very hot. It's very difficult to demonstrate or prove the effects on the food webs. You know, there's a crash of a predator of copepods because the volume was there. It hasn't been documented quite yet. So anyway, we can document these. These are very good indicators. Certainly of invasive species that have occurred, and most likely the modes or the vehicle of introduction was in ballast water going into the Columbia River, Port of Portland or Port of Vancouver, or something like that. Okay. So we actually have something called the Washington State Aquatic Nuisance Species Watch List. Okay, and there's a committee in the state of Washington, and they've been meeting and talking about non-indigenous species or invasive species that have been introduced in the state of Washington, try to produce a list. And this is a list, I'm not going to belabor this, but there's a wide variety of organisms, primarily invertebrates, okay, that have been introduced into the state of Washington. And these introductions are suggested, it's always suggested, by ballast waters. You know, it's kind of hard to find the smoking gun with ballast water. No one was there when the ship arrived that deposited these non-indigenous species and have that sample. But they have been found in ballast water. Okay, we're not sure exactly which ship was the one responsible. It may have been a ship many years ago, and it took many years for particular non-indigenous species to establish itself in a particular environment. And I just want to indicate on this slide here, these groups of organisms have received quite a bit of attention recently. These are tunicates, okay, and these are organisms that are people are a little bit nervous about because they tend to coat strata, substrate. Okay, coat the bottoms, coat oyster trays, coat pilings, and that sort of thing. And so these are very insidious types of organisms that tend to coat. And whether they establish themselves permanently has been demonstrated, but there's quite a bit of attention given to this, okay, these introductions. So one of the major things about invasive species, particularly in the aquatic environment, is that once something is introduced, it's hard to take it out. Sort of the ounce of prevention is worth a pound of cure, is probably the philosophy you take care of. Before I get too far, I just want to mention, I also have to think about microorganisms too, not just the invertebrates, and this goes back to a paper that was published quite a few years ago, okay, in 1994. Where an individual suggested that Vireo cholera, which is a human pathogen that causes great devastation in third world countries, you know, refugee camps, and that sort of thing, may have been introduced into South America through ballast water. Okay, and a lot of it's just kind of a series of findings that strongly suggest that this may have occurred. And they found, basically, you could find this pathogen in ballast water ships that come into the Gulf of Mexico. And the types of organisms, we're not only looking at species that are invasive, but actually strains of species that are invasive. Okay, not every Vireo cholera causes the disease cholera. There's certain particular strains or subsets of the species that cause the disease. And they found that the isolates out of these ships was all indistinguishable, very similar to what was found in the pandemic that was going through Central and South America. Okay, so it looks like there's some similarity going there. And that these isolates that were found in the ships differed from the ones that were naturally found, the ones that were endemic in the Gulf of Mexico. And so quite a few years ago, this is the Food and Drug Administration actually recommended that the U.S. Coast Guard consider ballast water exchange. And this was years before it became in effect. It was actually a public health agency suggested that maybe ships that are going from one region of the world to another should perform this activity where they sort of flush out their ballast tanks on near shore waters from like Asia or China or Japan with mid-oceanic water with the idea that the organisms are found in the middle of the ocean would cause less harm or be less likely to be introduced to near shore environments like the North America. Okay.
So,
the other thing to think about with ballast water is not just water. Okay, there's sediments at the bottom of the tanks. And so many organisms have resistance stages, like spores or cysts. And these resistance stages oftentimes sort of settle out and they can be found in sediments and remain viable for a long period of time when sort of conditions become right, where how right is defined. These organisms, once again, become vegetative cells and reproduce and so forth. And so there was an interest in what's going on here in these sediments here that need to be deposited in the bottom of the ballast tanks. And a couple studies came out of Australia that looked at the transport of diatoms and dinoflagellate resting spores, or cysts, that are found in the ship's ballast water. And what does this mean for ballast water? Our plankton biogeography and aquaculture. And years later, they began to look at the transport of not just any sort of plankton, but toxic dinoflagellates via ballast water, and look at sort of the economic impacts of that. And this fellow here, Gustav Hollengroff of in Australia, is one of the major investigators in this area. And this is some of the conclusions they came to from their studies. They found, first of all, there were viable cultures here, living cultures of paralytic shellfish poisoning, PSP, causing dinoflagellates, and this is the genus Alexandria, there's a couple of species of that, were found in ships that would be coming from Japan, Korea, and going into Australia. And some of these numbers are pretty phenomenal. In fact, this one species of this Alexandrian, which is a PSP causing dinoflagellate, talking about 300 million. Okay, so we're not talking about a few dozen here. Large numbers, both in volume of ballast water and both in numbers of organisms that are found in ballast water. They later performed a sediment core in Tasmania and looked at another species that they thought maybe wasn't there originally but was introduced. So you go in the sediments and actually begin to do some dating of those sediments, you know how old those sediments are as you go down, it gets older and older. And they found that this one species, which is Gymnavinium, okay, they found the cyst of it in 1973, and it just happened to be the same year at that port where they established a new facility that was exporting wood chips from Australia, exporting. So ships coming to that port, devoid of any cargo, filled with ballast water, the cargo holds filled with ballast water, similar to those photographs I showed earlier about the grain chips. And so, as the same year that mill was established. So the suggestion is very strong that perhaps this genus was introduced in 73 at the same time, began importing a lot of this ballast water from other regions of the world. So one of the paradigms, at least with some biologists, is that you can find everything everywhere. But that's not true, okay. Particularly in near-shore environments. So we do have this thing of non-indigenous versus indigenous species occurring, particularly in near-shore environments. Okay. So the suggestion is that ballast water, or the transport of large volumes of water carrying non-indigenous species from one part of the world to another, can introduce organisms that were not originally present in that receiving location. So what are you going to do? Okay. This is the current technology for handling the transfer of non-indigenous species in ballast water. It's called ballast water exchange. So basically swap out their water in their ballast tanks. And the location may vary between what state or what sort of regulations you're following. In the state of Washington, ships that are traveling up the coast from California, Oregon, must exchange their ballast water at least 50 nautical miles from the coast of Washington. Okay, so they have to swap it out. Ships that are traveling into the United States, they follow a Coast Guard regulation that mandates ballast water exchange at least 200 nautical miles off the coast of the United States. Okay. So there's two methods of doing this. It's kind of low tech here. Okay. Are you going to swap out your waterway? You can go two ways. You can basically empty all the water that's in the ballast tank and fill it up again in the middle of the ocean. The other method is actually where you just kind of turn the spigot on and just leave it come in and leave it pump into that ballast tank so it overflows. And if you do two or three volumes of water through this flow-through method, you get theoretically 95% exchange. Okay. Both of these take time. We're talking about maybe a half day to a day in order to accomplish this task. It has to be done very methodically. You sort of think about it, you know, if you begin to empty tanks in the middle of a ship, basically putting torque on that vessel hull, so it starts makes you twist a little bit. Okay, so it puts stress on that vessel, and it has to be done very methodically so you don't have those problems like I showed in the photographs earlier, which on that second photograph, a cougar ace off the Gulf of Alaska, they attribute that problem to trying to do a ballast water exchange.
Okay, that's a little thing. So I want to talk about a little bit about what's coming to the state of Washington.
So what are we showing here? We initiated a sampling program of sampling ballast water in tanks for ships coming at the port of Seattle, primary port of Tacoma. This is done by looking at the zooplankton, doing vertical plankton tows like you do in oceanography. And we identify those zooplankton to the lowest taxonomic, which I identify the species, that's what that means, if possible. And with part of that identification, we try to attribute or identify them as whether they're coastal organisms. If you're doing a mid-oceanic exchange, you shouldn't be finding a whole lot of coastal organisms in that ballast tank. They should be primarily oceanic organisms. And we also try to identify whether they're non-indigenous or indigenous to Washington waters. So from 2001 to 2007, we examined about 380 ships. And this is what it kind of looks like. Okay, these are not our guys. These guys on the vessel, they think this is really cool. They get to see something different. So it's operating a ship. You know, I was joking, oh, you know what you find? That fish down there? No, no. And we tend to see, well, these will see zooplankton that are present there. So very small organisms. And so this plankton net was dropped through the opening in this ballast tank, and you do a vertical tow, and depending on the instruction and the configuration of the ballast tank, sometimes you get to the bottom, sometimes you can't get to the bottom because they have, things are in the way. And so that the organisms that are collected in this plankton net are concentrated down this one end and then placed into a little jar where we add some formaldehyde, and it's brought to our lab for identification. So first of all, we work with the Washington Department of Fish and Wildlife, U.S. Coast Guard, and ships are required to file a ballast water report. Okay. Governments are really good at creating reports for industries and various businesses, so they have to file a report. I know this was a little bit faint here, but we're interested, okay, where are the ships exchanging their ballast water? And so every one of these little dots or circles you see present on this image here, I apologize for the whiteness of it, is where, a location where a ship reported they were doing their ballast water exchange. And you'll see here, the bigger the circles, the more coastal taxa that were found in those dots. Okay, so even if a ship was reporting doing exchange here off the coast of Washington, quite a few organisms were coastal taxa per cubic meter. Okay, cubic meter is 1,000 meters. Okay.
So it really varied. It's all over the North Pacific here where they're doing this ballast water exchange.
Ships that are coming from California into the state of Washington are required to go at least 50 nautical miles. And there's actually a dotted line here you can barely see one up here, and this is the location here. And once again, circles and dots and just a wide distribution of numbers from very low to very high as far as the numbers of coastal taxa that were found in these cubic meters of water. It's kind of looking at data a wide variety of ways. Okay. We segregated the ships that are ones that are doing coastal traffic coming up to the west coast of the United States versus the ones that are going across the Pacific. Okay. And so we report the densities per cubic meter. And let me just circle some things here. Okay, so we're thinking per 1,000 liters per cubic meter. Our time is the same thing. Okay. And you'll see that measure unit throughout here. On the west coast, about 2,500 organisms in a cubic meter that were zooplankton, greater than the mesh size of the network that's capturing them. The ones that are going across the Pacific, the numbers are much lower, okay, less than, you know, 400, 500. So the big differences between densities or concentrations of organisms that are on the west coast versus Pacific Ocean. And then if you begin to look at the differences between these are coastal organisms, much larger percentage, much larger numbers of coastal organisms are being transported up the west coast versus ones that are coming across the Pacific Ocean. Now these voyages can be maybe 3 to 5 days at most. These could be 2 to 3 weeks. So there's a big difference in voyage lengths between the ships that are going these two sorts of patterns. There's also some variations on types of vessels. How we try to break it out again here. Here's a container of ships. These are the types you see here with the big boxes on top. And they carry relatively small amounts of ballast. They do very minimal amounts of ballast water discharge. The point we're trying to make here is even for the same vessel types, if you look to the left side here, these open circles are always less than these blue dots. Okay, blue dots, West Coast, Trans-Pacific. So once again, much lower numbers of organisms, even for the same vessel type, that's coming across the Pacific Ocean versus ones that are coming up the West Coast. We also have some vessel types that are trading along the West Coast that don't go across the Pacific Ocean. These two vessel types on the end here, which have received quite a bit of attention, are referred to as integrated or articulated tug barges. Okay, if you look from a distance, they look like a tanker. Okay. And what these are doing is actually carrying, for the most part, refined hydrocarbon products like gasoline from refineries in Puget Sound down to Southern California. Okay. So they're carrying the product down to Southern California, they're coming back to the Northwest totally empty of products. They have large quantities of ballast water that they discharge into the Northwest before they fill it up again with gasoline and take it back down to Southern California. And so with these are integrated tug barges and tanker barges that are carrying gasoline to Southern California. Once again, these are log densities here, which for the most part we present, let me show that, logs. Okay, so 10-fold difference is 10,000. So these small distances here represent 10-fold differences, so big differences. But once again, just trying to get the trend, our greatest number of organisms that are being introduced into the state of Washington are actually, concentration-wise, are coming from the coastal traffic coming out of the West Coast.
Okay.
Same message here, okay? We can split it out. The ships coming from China, Japan, Korea, Pacific Ocean. If we look at the different countries, here's all the Asian countries. Geometric mean of densities, okay, per cubic meter. So we're looking at less than 50 per cubic meter, which is a very low concentration. That's 50 zooplankton in 1,000 liters. Not a whole lot of concentration. Compare that to something from California. Okay, you see a lot of red. Red refers to non-indigenous taxa. Okay. These are organisms identified as non-indigenous. We've gone beyond to say whether they're coastal or oceanic. They're actually non-indigenous. And so where do you think most of these are probably coming from, the non-indigenous organisms? There's not a whole number. There's several ports in California. Which port do you think, or which area of the state do you think is bringing greatest number of non-indigenous organisms to the state of Washington? Take a guess. Could it be Sacramento? Yeah. The two ports we mentioned up front here, okay. Long Beach, Los Angeles, huge, makes Seattle look like a little tiny port. Okay. And the other major port areas in San Francisco Bay, was Oakland, and there's a bunch of other cities around there. Does anybody know? Is San Francisco Bay highly invaded estuary? Yes or no? Yes. Where did it mostly come from? Asia. So most of the Asian species are probably being introduced in the state of Washington, like the ones I showed in Columbia earlier. Probably originated out of San Francisco that were jumping up here, rather than the ones coming from Asia. Because first of all, you're starting off with a much higher concentration coming from San Francisco or California compared to Asia. Just the length of that voyage, and the fact that doing some ballast water exchange, these organisms will actually naturally die off slowly on these voyage patterns. Okay? It's much shorter voyage, much greater chance of surviving the length of that voyage. Okay. Just some different colors here. Okay. West Coast versus Trans-Pacific vessel types. Okay. Individuals that would be average discharge per ship. Individuals per ship. You look at that as inoculation pressure, it's a term that's used in invasion biology, or propagule pressure, or propagules. Okay. Individuals times 10 to the 6, okay, that's a million. Okay. Container vessel, okay, this is the Trans-Pacific Coastal. The blue bar is always much higher than the pink bars. ITB, these are the ones that carry gasoline. So we're talking about millions of organisms released per vessel, it's not a small number, a few dozen, but millions of non-indigenous organisms, or excuse me, not numbers of organisms, not, and a large percentage of them are non-indigenous. This is total numbers of organisms. So the amount of inoculation coming from California ports is tremendous for the state of Washington.
So this is another reason to hate people from California.
He said, you're bringing us all your non-indigenous organisms, you're invading us, not just in terrestrial side, but also on the aquatic side. Okay. Okay, here's some conclusions.
From that, this is in a manuscript that's been submitted and accepted for publication. Despite Washington state regulations requiring oceanic exchange, they're supposed to be doing this. And one thing we have to say, one caveat is we weren't on the best to make sure they were actually doing it or whether they did it well. We're just going by the reports. They reported they did it, we did it at this location. Ships had high densities of non-indigenous species, NIS, or coastal species.
So that's still occurring, large numbers.
Densities, okay, concentrations or densities of high risk taxa, NIS, coastal taxa, were consistently and significantly higher from U.S. domestic trips, in other words, for say, in California, dominated by tank ships from California. Okay, tank ships, these are the ships that are carrying refined product from the state of Washington, from like the different refineries down south. They come back empty, okay, filled with ballast water. And so that's another thing we found. It was actually kind of a surprise. I think we went into this thinking, oh, everything's coming from Asia, but actually our most likely source for problem is actually probably California. Okay, densities of high-risk taxa in non-indigenous or coastal, lower in samples from Trans-Pacific, dominated by container ships and bulk carriers. So two things are going on there. We have different locations, but overlaying the data is also different vessel types are associated with different locations. So it makes it difficult to tease whether it's one thing or it's another across. This is the type of ships that are bringing all the Nikes and iPods and everything else from China into North America. Container ships and bulk carriers. Okay, the bulk carriers are the ones taking the grains from the Pacific Northwest, or even other products like wood products to Asia. Come here empty, but actually having less of an impact probably than the ships that come from California.
Okay. So what are you going to do about this? I'll spend just a little time on this.
Discharge standards. This has all happened in the last few years. People have gotten rooms, I don't know if they're smoke-filled like they used to be, but these rooms in the middle of the night, you say, okay, let's put some numbers for discharge. How many organisms will we permit to be discharged into the United States or whatever country you're thinking of, Brazil, so forth? What's happened is that somewhat in their finite or infinite wisdom, they decide to size class the organisms that are in ballast water into two major size fractions. Those that are greater than 50 micrometers in size, and those that are between 10 and 50 micrometers in size. Okay, general, okay, these are mostly zooplankton, but there's some phytoplankton that are bigger than 50 microns. And then you run into something like dinoflagellates and some of the smaller diatoms. So anyway, they sort of segregate based on taxa, but it's not a very clean separation. And so the International Maritime Organization, which is like the United Nations for ships, decided with this number here, they would accept less than 10 per cubic meter. This came out about 4 years ago. I said, wow, this is phenomenal. It's a low number. I'm pretty impressed with that number. It's much lower than what you find coming in with their ballast water sampling. And then for the same organization, for something between 10 and 50, less than 10 per milliliter, okay, which is kind of a small number once again if you compare it to the naturally what's found. Just last year, and it was enacted in January of this year, California kind of took the, said, we got to be different here, and we're going to take it even further because our numbers are going to be even tougher. Okay. And they said, hey, came out with this language, no detectable living organisms. Okay. I'm a scientist, and I'll sit through out there and measure these numbers, and you say no detectable. It's like, do I empty the whole ship into this little plankton net or something? I don't have to do this. It's, oh, no, we're just needing smaller nets, it's okay. Okay. So anyway, the regulatory agencies and the people that are meeting in the rooms coming up with these numbers, kind of the science that goes along with trying to measure these numbers, it's having some difficulties, because these are very low numbers. 10 was pretty low. No, it was really low. And some U.S. legislation, which is still pending, we say that every year now, will probably take this maybe 100-fold less than this. So extremely low numbers per cubic meter, extremely low numbers per milliliter, much lower than what's naturally found. So this, other than saying that the science behind it is, okay, low numbers is better than high numbers, okay? Whether this should be, 2 times 10 to whatever, no one can come up with these numbers. It's very hard to figure out.
How many numbers for different types of organisms. And there's also numbers for bacteria, but it tends to be related to public health organisms. And the numbers that are being bantered around for that with the IMO or California, actually within reason, okay, these are numbers that most public health authorities would say, okay, that's not too bad. Okay. So it's a real challenge with these low numbers. Okay, so the challenge for the treatments is to, you want us to kill the toughest organisms in ballast water. And you're sort of taking this approach, well, we can't be selective about, so we'll end up killing, we'll have to kill everything almost, or remove everything that's present there, because we're not sure what the next invasive species will be. And then on the other hand, you want us to be environmentally friendly. So when we discharge that ballast water, we don't kill everything that's in the environment, because of the treated water will be discharged. So this is really a challenge if you're looking at chemicals to treat ballast water, which tends to be the route many people are thinking about. To release a chemical-treated ballast water that's going to be environmentally friendly. It's sort of a bit kind of dichotomy there. And then you talk to the shipping industry, well, I have to work on a ship. Okay, doing your lab, I have to work on a ship. It has to be safe on a ship. And then lastly, it's like, how much does it cost? And we're talking about treatment costs, and you talk to most of the owners and operators, they want pennies per ton because there's a lot of tons of ballast water. Okay, so the cost has to be very minimal. And so there's a wide variety of ballast water treatments that are being contemplated. Almost anything you think of that kills organisms, someone's going to try it or suggest that. Well, let's try that ballast water. Well, how much is it going to cost if you're trying to do it? Like thousands of cubic meters. So these are the chemical biocides. The ones that are in red are some of the ones that we've worked on in our lab, both either on small scale laboratory benchtop or actually on ship scale experiments. Ozone, sodium hypochlorite, and fancy word for bleach. This is kind of you want sea clean. It's actually something called it's a vitamin K3. So if you come up with some novel treatment process or chemical, you might call it a cool trade name for it. Okay, that's another hint. Filtration. Okay, you're not going to take a millipore filter on a ship and expect to sterilize the water very easily. And then a bunch of physical methods, such as ultraviolet light, take the oxygen out. So a whole variety of methods. Then if all else fails and if there's enough room on the vessel, you start combining some of these together. Okay. I'll just skip through that one here. Now these experiments can be done with potential treatment at different scales. And what we're suggesting, we're highly recommending that you start small and work big. Because once you take it on the ship, the complexity of trying to do that work gets to be very, very complicated. So here's some small scale experiments, you know, less than 200 gallons we're working out at the marine station. If you need some organisms, you can just go out there, collect them with a plankton net, add them into those tanks. If you want to treat them with UV or some other thing. But then the challenge is, and all the owner operators said, well, it does work on a ship. So eventually you want to take it onto a ship. And for someone like me, who's a microbiologist that tends to deal with microliters, going onto a ship was a real eye-opener because they don't deal with microliters, I'll tell you that. Everything is really big. Okay, and so this one here has ballast tanks. This is an oil tanker we did some work on. Carries a lot of oil, carries a lot of valves. That would be about $80 million per load of crude oil that's coming down from Alaska. And if you look inside that ship, this is the tank. Okay, we did work with ozone, okay, which is a biocide used for swimming pools. And this particular prototype is introducing the ozone gas through these diffusers. Okay, so ozone gas was bubbling through these diffusers. And we knew instantly when we saw that there's going to be problems to get a good homogeneous mixture of ozone gas in those tanks by the diffusers. And so you want to bore, and you use some things like Nisqually bottles. You want to sample water at a particular depth. You do some chemistry because you're doing ozone chemistry. And the chemistry of ozone is actually fairly complicated, and you can take a zooplankton sample out of ballast tanks just to scare you a little bit. This is ozone chemistry in seawater. And what you're happening, I'm just going to go through quickly, is that the ozone that's there actually reacts very quickly with Br ions, or bromide ions. And so the disinfectant is not so much the ozone itself, it's actually these products, the OBR and HBR, which actually provide longer-lasting disinfectant power for that ozone, because these are water-soluble compounds. If any of you have done any hot tubbing, and use bromines, okay, these are referred to as bromines, these chemicals here. And so those are the ones that are causing the disinfections, and there's some extra side products that you don't want to see. And I'll just show you one data slide, okay, just for microorganisms, and these are bacteria. And so they turn on the ozonator, and they're bubbling through the tank, and we
wait for 2.5, 5, 7, and 10 hours. And so the take-home message is that after you treat that tank with ozone gas for maybe 5 to 10 hours and achieve a certain level of disinfectant, you get extremely low numbers of these bacteria.
And just kind of skipping ahead, these are the results from that. Okay, ozone diffuser system above the ballast tanks. And then bromines are formed. Okay, those are those
products from ozonation, OVR and HBR.
And so the different types of organisms that we're looking at, tremendous declines in population. So this is like a pretty good idea as far as treating ballast water. The problem was in this last statement here is that the ozone wasn't homogeneous throughout that ballast tank. So we found some spots where it wasn't killing it as effectively as others. And so he said, well, he was a biologist. This is kind of a stupid way to introduce ozone to these diffusers. So the companies and the technologists that are involved with this said, okay, we're going to look for an alternative way to install this ozone system. Instead of putting it through diffusers in the bottom of the tanks, we're going to actually inject the ozone all at once into the ballast tank that goes into the ballast pipe that goes into all those ballast tanks. And so that's what they're working on now. So my concluding remarks.
Last slide. Ballast water exchange, as currently practiced, we have to say that, is releasing large numbers of non-indigenous and or coastal organisms in Puget Sound. Question I throw out to you, do you care? Should you care? Well, maybe it's zebra mussels if you care. How far should we go to prevent introductions of non-indigenous aquatic species? As I said earlier,
it's sort of the ounce of prevention, the pound of cure.
To minimize aquatic introductions in the future, preventive measures must be performed. Okay, once it's out there and propagated, it's hard to take it out again. Difficult to impossible to eradicate invasive species.
In the aquatic environment, it's hard to see them all. Okay.
Many potential ballast water treatment technologies are being considered, limitations and positive attributes of each technology. I just touched upon ozone today. We've involved with some other treatment technologies.
So there's a lot of pluses and minuses that need to be considered. I think the last comment I would make,
the scientists and engineers must work together not only finding environmental problems, we're pretty good at finding all these problems, but we also want to work together to find solutions.
Okay? And I'll stop there and leave you with this if you have time to read it.